There's a reason for it. Again, I like to say, before I reveal the name of this tribe, that when the land was being divided into portions and given to the 12 tribes of Israel, even though this one son was fifth or sixth in line as far as the age of the sons were concerned, and since it was customary in the Jewish law that any gifts given or any honor bestowed would be so according to age and the time of birth rather than according to skill or according to ability, it seems strange at this time that when the land was being divided into portions to be given to the 12 tribes, that when the turn of this one son came around, he was bypassed and his part was given to another until all 11 tribes had received their portion of the land of Canaan, and then the portion that was left, which happened to be the north region of the land of Palestine, bordering the land of Syria, was given to him. Now, why was he bypassed, and why was this portion of land given to him rather than he receiving his portion according to his place as far as his birth date was concerned? And when this tribe moved over to the north region of Palestine, an introduction of idol worship was made. This son built a city. He called it after his own name, and he built a graven image, and he called it and gave it the most sacred name that God had shared with the leadership of Israel. A name that was to be used once a year, and that on the Day of Atonement, when the high priest went into the Holy of Holies to stand before the Ark of the Covenant and the mercy seat, after sprinkling the mercy seat with the blood of the sacrifice, awaiting the atoning power of God to the sins of the people. That was the only time and in the only place that the name Yahweh was to be used. However, this tribe, led by this son of Jacob, built this graven image, blaspheming the most sacred name of God by using it as a given name, or by giving this name rather to this graven image. Not only that, but he induced or tried to compel all of the 12 tribes, rather than go to the city of Jerusalem to worship there in the holy temple of God, to come over to the northern region of Palestine where this graven image had been built, in the city that was named after him, to worship that graven image. Idol worship was so strong over there that the region became known as the region of darkness. Thus, this man became guilty of the act of blasphemy. And since Moses, in his writings in the book of Leviticus, declared that a blasphemer of the name of the Lord should be put to death, so doth this man subject himself to the judgment of God, because he becomes a blasphemer as well. Now, what I'm going to say is not recorded in the Bible. However, it comes from reliable sources, for I have received this information from one of the Orthodox rabbis in the city of Jerusalem, recorded in some of the ancient manuscripts of the history of their people. And it tells a little bit about the character of this one son, the 12 sons of Jacob. When Joseph was elevated to the position of second ruler of Egypt, and he was responsible for the bringing of his brothers and his father and the rest of the family over to the land of Egypt, they were given the land of Goshen to dwell in, and the Pharaoh of Egypt favored Joseph very highly, so much so that he became the second ruler of Egypt. One of the 12 sons of Jacob, the same son that Moses called a lion's whelp, and Jacob himself named as a serpent, or described as a serpent or an adder, conspired with the crown prince of Egypt to assassinate Joseph and his wife Asenath before they could give birth, or before they could have any children, deceiving the crown prince of Egypt to believe that Joseph would occupy the throne of Egypt when his father passed away, and that he, as a crown, as the heir to the crown of Egypt, would not occupy that throne as long as Joseph was alive. And in the event that Joseph and Asenath died, or Joseph died, and they had male children born to them, then the son of Joseph will inherit the throne of Egypt. And by lying to the crown prince of Egypt relative to this matter concerning Joseph, he and that crown prince conspired to kill Joseph and Asenath, and thus eliminate any threat to his occupying the throne of Egypt. But that conspiracy fell through. Prior to that, the same historic manuscripts that this Jewish rabbi has in his possession declared also that Dan, who is this son, was a chief conspirator in the plot that was made against Joseph to kill him. And because he was not successful in putting through this plot, he had to succumb to the alternative of selling him to a band of Ishmaelites, and by so doing he thought he had gotten rid of him. And all this time, of course, Satan has been in the background working through this boy, Dan. Well, you know now what the name of this tribe is, the tribe of Dan. Now, the meaning of the name Dan is God hath judged me. And so you can see for yourself that when Moses called Dan and described his tribe as a lion's whelp, he was talking about the beginning of the strategy of Satan to destroy the Messiah and to destroy all of the efforts of the Messiah to bring salvation to mankind and a restoration to the Jew. And a lion's whelp, of course, in time, was to grow and mature to become a full-grown, ferocious lion. So that at the time of the coming of the Antichrist, the prophecy of Moses relative to Dan and his tribe would have been fulfilled to the place where out of that tribe would come forth a personage that would have the characteristics of a roaring lion, same characteristics given to Satan himself. As for Jacob's prophecy, describing Dan as a serpent, we know very well that Satan is described in the Bible as a serpent, and he's also described as a lion to us. And the fact that the tribulation period related to the Jew, when the Jew will suffer his greatest time of tribulation, are called Jacob's trouble, or Jacob's days of trouble, is not strange that the patriarch Jacob was picked, a man, and his name was chosen to name these times of indignation relative to the Jewish nation. For it was Jacob himself that had a vision of his people going through a severe time of tribulation at the hands of the man of sin who was to come out of the tribe of Dan, which tribe Jacob had just got through calling a serpent by the way, an adder in the path that biteth the horse's heel so that his rider shall fall backward. And then he cries out, I have waited for thy salvation, O Lord. It's as though Jacob saw his people going through this time of tribulation and suffering at the hands of the Antichrist, whose lineage dates back to the tribe of Dan. And seeing that, he also sees the salvation of the Lord as it comes to the remnant of his people. And having described Dan as a serpent, he also cries out, I have waited for thy salvation, O God. Now the Antichrist, of course, being an apostate Jew, will rise out of the province of the ancient Roman Empire, somewhere from some of the countries that were part of the ancient Roman Empire. This apostate Jew will appear to declare his position as a leader and a ruler and a dictator of the world, heading the last form of Gentile dominion and power on the face of this earth. He is not only going to be supported by his intellectual powers, his dynamic personality, his military powers, his ability to express himself, or his subtlety, his wisdom, but he's going to be supported by more than that. For there will be a false prophet who will serve as his forerunner, who will have the ability to perform signs, wonders, and miracles. And not only he, but as Daniel tells us also in the 11th chapter, the man of sin himself, the Antichrist, will have the power to perform wonders and miracles as well. For he shall be strong in the world, and he shall do in the most stronghold with a strange god whom he shall acknowledge. And that strange god, of course, will be Satan himself. And his powers will be so great in his performance of signs, wonders, and miracles that the world will be convinced that he is a superman and he is a god and he deserves to be worshipped and honored and exalted as such. However, these miracles and these wonders will be lying miracles and wonders. Now, of course, there is a man today that lives in the desert of Syria. He lives in a very ultra-modern palace, very close to the border of Mesopotamia, at the foot of a mountain there, in the heart of the desert. His palace is surrounded by a high wall, and he has a legion, a camel legion, they call it, that guards the palace night and day. And no one can come anywhere within a radius of 20 miles of the walls of that palace. In order for anyone to have audience with this individual, they have to go to the city of Damascus. And in the city of Damascus, he has a representative there. And any individual wishing audience with the Antichrist, with this man, would have to have papers of high quality recommending him in order for him to be allowed audience with this personality. Now, this man, of course, dates his lineage all the way back to Abraham. And I have the listing of the names of the historical figures that he dates his lineage to, all the way back to Abraham. And they are very authentic. And they are historical. They can be traced in the annals of history, every one of them. He's approximately 68 years old now. However, he does not look like a 68-year-old man, but looks like a 30-year-old man. But it seems as though, having reached the age of 30, this man ceased to age. He is tall, a little over 6 feet tall, almost a perfect specimen of manhood. Very, very handsome. Very, very striking in his appearance. This man is able to perform miracles and wonders. And we have definite proof, of course, of his ability to do so. Now, we talk about miracles and we talk about wonders, and we want to be sure in our study today not to confuse the display of magic with these miracles and wonders of the beast and the false prophet. Of course, magic is powerful in itself. And I don't know just how much magic any one of you has seen here. But having lived in the part of the world where mysticism began, where it actually originated, I have been privileged to see magic performed. Some years ago, I was in Cairo, Egypt, and I went to view a magic show. Magicians were coming from all parts of the world to participate in this magic showing. However, they had one especially featured who was considered the world's prominent magician. I sat very close to the stage because I wanted to see everything as close as I possibly could. And when the showing began, they had a few second-rate magicians that came to the stage and they did their acts. One of them, for example, appeared before the audience and he had a long sword, steel sword, about 4 feet long, with handles on it. And he commenced to put that sword in his mouth, and he kept pushing it down inside his body until all 4 feet of that sword were inside his body with the handles of the sword resting against the lower lip of his mouth. And some people in the audience went up to the stage and they held the handle of the sword and kind of tried to make sure that it wasn't inside the collar of his shirt, but it was inside his mouth. And there was no doubt about it, the sword had entered the body of that man, all 4 feet of it. 4 feet of steel inside the body of this human being. And when he finally pulled that sword out of his mouth and out of his body, there was not a drop of blood on it, or a drop of moisture whatsoever. Somebody said, oh, that was an optical illusion. No, sir, it wasn't an optical illusion. It was a reality. Well, somebody said, maybe by practice a person can do that. Well, maybe so, but why don't you try practicing putting a toothpick down your throat and see how fast you begin to gag and to choke? Or try to put a pen down your throat and see how long you can last before you begin to gag and choke. Now, the power of magic is very, very strong, and this man was able, by magical powers, to put that sword into his body through his mouth and allow it to rest inside his body, 4 feet of steel. Well, you say that's not all that fascinating or exciting. Well, he left the stage. Another magician came on the stage, and this fellow had a helper with him who stood to his right. And when he started his act, he started by opening his mouth and reaching into his mouth. He began to pull wadded handkerchiefs of all colors tied to a string. And he kept pulling one handkerchief after the other. And that helper of his held the end of that string, and he kept walking away from him as this man pulled one handkerchief after another out of his mouth, until by the time he pulled the last wadded handkerchief out of his mouth, he had a string of handkerchiefs that had 150 handkerchiefs on it. And every one of those handkerchiefs tied to that string came out of that man's mouth. Now, where he had them in his mouth, I don't know. How in the world is a man able to stuff 150 handkerchiefs into his mouth? I don't know. They were ordinary sized handkerchiefs, not little bitty ones, but ordinary sized handkerchiefs that you carry in your pocket and you use. And they were of different colors. And they were moist, no doubt about it. They came out of his mouth and out of his body. And he had them somewhere in his anatomy. Where and how, I don't know, but I can tell you this one thing. You can try it if you want to. And if you go beyond the number 5 of water handkerchief in your mouth, you're doing real well before you gag and choke to death. And this man pulled 150 out of them. And that, of course, was through the power of magic. magic is strong, it has power, it's induced by Satan himself. Because God himself is against magic, and God himself, using Moses to tell us how he despises magic and how abominable magic is in his sight, and not only magic, but several other practices that are in the world today, that possibly some even Pentecostal people are guilty of playing around with and showing interest in, that are abominable in the eyes of the Lord. Moses writes in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 18 and verses 9 through 12, "Thou shalt not learn to do after the abomination," and the word abomination means shameful, vile, hateful, in the highest degree, "of those nations. There shall not be found with thee anyone that useth divination," that's a fortune teller, "observer of times," that's an astrologer, "an enchanter, a magician, a witch, a sorcerer, a charmer," which is a hypnotist, "a consulter with familiar spirits, a medium possessed with a spiritual guide, or a wizard." A wizard is a clairvoyant, a psychic, an extrasensory perceptor, and a necromancer, a medium who consults with the dead. "For all that do these things are an abomination unto the Lord." And so the power of magic is of the devil. And after, of course, these two magicians had performed, and a few others that followed them with minor demonstrations of magic, then the time was given to the featured magician. And after a while, the curtain lifted, and this man walked on the stage, and the crowds went wild. Began to clap, they applauded, they whistled, they hollered, they shouted. Some of them threw their hats in the air in this great auditorium in the city of Cairo, in the heart of Egypt. And this man just came and stood in the center of the stage with a smirk on his face, stood tall and straight, and looked at the audience. Never said a word. Never moved a muscle in his face. His face was set, and his mouth was set in a snicker. It's as though he was looking at a people that were so far below him and so inferior to him. And he compelled those people by his look to finally quiet down. And when it dawned upon those people who were applauding how compelling the presence of this man was, you could hear him gradually here and there all over that Colosseum, dying out and quieting down until silence seemed to reign in that Colosseum. You could almost hear a pin drop. And then all of a sudden, sitting there, I felt as though I was bound to that man. And I held my breath. And I realized later on that every person that was sitting in that Colosseum was holding their breath as well. The whole atmosphere's breathing was bated by the presence of this magician. And he kept us held. And he held us rather captive for almost 3 minutes, and it seemed like 3 hours. And finally he relaxed and moved his eyes from the audience. And you could hear a sigh of relief all over that audience. Anyway, the first thing he did was ask for someone to go and get him an orange. And several people out of the audience ran outside and to get him an orange. And in the city of Cairo, of course, they have peddlers and vendors on the street corners all over the city of Cairo, all hours of the day and night. So it wasn't hard for somebody to come and find a peddler with a cart with oranges and fruits on it, especially outside the Colosseum, waiting for the people to come out so that they could sell their fruits to them. And several people came back with several oranges, and he inspected all of those oranges they brought to him and picked out the one that had the least blemish on it, cuts or bruises whatsoever, a whole orange. And he passed it around for everybody to see the orange, and they passed it back to him. And he asked for a knife, and he held that orange in front of everybody, very clear, very distinct, now it's close enough to see him holding that orange with two fingers. And he brought that knife, and he cut that orange in half. And while he was cutting, you could see the juice dripping from the cut of that orange. And then finally he cut it in two halves, and he opened that orange, and lo and behold, out of that orange, he produced a folded 5-pound Egyptian note, wet and soaking with orange juice. And just prior to asking for an orange, he had asked for somebody in the audience to give him a 5-pound note, or let him borrow for just a minute or two a 5-pound note. And some gentleman had come and brought him a 5-pound note, and this fellow had taken a match out, and he struck that match, and he burned that 5-pound note. And of course, it scared this fellow, and he said, "Hey, I want my 5-pound note." And the fellow, the magician, told him, "Well, don't worry about it now. I'll give it to you in just a minute or so." And when he produced that folded 5-pound note, he unfolded it. He shook it a little bit to get all the wetness out of it and wiped it real clean on both sides. And he called this gentleman whose 5-pound note he had borrowed and burned, and he told him, "Here is a 5-pound note. It's just as valuable as yours and negotiable. The only difference in yours and mine, yours was dry and mine is a little wet." Well, you say that's not all that exciting. Maybe not, but you try to do it sometime and see if you find anything in that orange besides seeds. Then he called for a woman from the audience to come up to the platform, and of all of the women that have responded, a real skinny woman came, and she looked like 6 o'clock. She was so skinny. And she stood before him, and he looked at her, and he said, "Have you ever been hypnotized?" And she said, "No." He said, "Would you like to be hypnotized?" And she didn't know whether she would like it or not, and before she could make up her mind to say yea or nay, he had her hypnotized. And he began to move his hands forward and backward on either side of her. And she began to swing backward and forward like the pendulum of a clock. And she'd swing all the way backward as far as his hands would move. And he'd have her swinging forward as far as the hands would move. And then he began to wave his hands sideways. And she began to swing from side to side. Again, just like the pendulum of a clock, with the motions of his hand. Precisely with the motions of his hand. When his hand moved to the right, she swung to the right. When he moved to the left, she swung to the left. And he kept her swinging left to right, and left to right, and left to right. And finally brought her to a stationary position, and his hand stopped, and she stopped swinging. Then he raised his hands up in the air, and when he did so without touching her, she began to rise up off the floor of that stage and began to float in the air upright. And somebody may say, "Well, he probably had a real thin piece of wire tied around her neck, and somebody from the ceiling was pulling her." Well, that's a lot of nonsense. There was no such person in the ceiling. And the ceiling was so high and flat, and you could have seen the wire, and the lights were very, very bright on the stage, and we were close enough to have seen anything tied to that woman pulling her Besides, it would be an effort to pull a woman like that from that high of a ceiling up and down and cause her to swing in such a precise manner on the platform as well. No, no, there was nothing tied around her neck, no wire, no string. No one was pulling her up from the ceiling of that Colosseum. It was a power of this magician that was causing this woman to rise up from the floor of that stage and to be suspended in midair. He raised his hands up, she'd go up. He'd bring him down, she'd come down. Finally, he raised her up high enough where he swung his hands around and her body rotated and began to float sideways. And there she was suspended sideways in midair. Again, he would raise his hands up and she would rise up, and he'd lower his hands and she be lowered. And finally, he placed his hands about a foot's distance underneath her body in a stationary way, and her body became stationary in the air. There she was, suspended between the ceiling of that Colosseum and the floor of that stage in a stationary position. Then he called for somebody to bring him two chairs. And they brought two chairs, and he had them place one chair immediately beneath the head of that woman and the chair beneath the heels of that woman. And when those chairs were placed in position, he began to lower his hands, and as he lowered his hands, the body of that woman began to lower also, until finally her head, the back of her head, rested on one chair, and the back of her legs or feet rested on the other chair, and there was nothing underneath a middle part of her body. She was straight as a piece of wood. And then he asked for three large men to come out to the audience, to the platform, to the stage. And several large men came, and he chose the largest and fattest of them, three of them, and believe me, looking at them, they looked like every one of them weighed over 300 pounds, and altogether they must have weighed close to 1,000 pounds. He looked at the first one, and he said, "I want you to sit on the face of this woman." And the man looked so surprised and shocked, he says, "You want me to sit on her face? Why," he said, "I will kill her." He said, "You sit on her face." And while the fellow was objecting, this man looked at him and said, "Sit down," with a voice of authority. And the man sat down on that woman's face, and her nose didn't budge, bend, wilt. Her face, her skin was not moved one little bit. It was as though her face was made of iron. He looked at the second man. He said, "I want you to sit on her ankles." And the man said, "Why, I break her feet. Look how skinny her legs are and her ankles." And he looked at him. He said, "Sit down." And that same voice of authority called that man to flop down on that woman's ankle. He sat down and nothing happened. He looked at the third one. And the third one now realized where he was going to have to sit. And he told him, "I want you to sit on this woman's abdomen, on her stomach." "Why," he said, "there's nothing underneath to prop her." And he said, "I'll break her in half." He said, "Sit down." And the man sat down on that woman's stomach, on her midriff. And she didn't bend one little bit. And there were 1,000 pounds of weight sitting on a woman that weighed less than 85 pounds. And she did not bend, she did not move, she did not break, nothing happened to her. She was able to hold up the weight of all of these three men that together totaled in weight about 1,000 pounds. Well, he had them get off her and go back to their places, and he raised his hands up, and the woman was raised from those two chairs. He straightened her up in an upright position and brought his hands all the way down until her feet touched the floor of that Colosseum stage, And then he brought her back too. And she shook her head a little bit. And he said, you know what happened to you? And she said, no. Well, he said, I better not tell you right now. I'm afraid you might faint on me. And he sent her back to her place. Now, this is the power of magic. However, when I talk about signs and wonders and miracles, I am talking about something that is far more spectacular yet than the power of magic. And this is the kind of a power that this man, whose name is Abdul Abul Baha, who lives in this ultra-modern palace right in the heart of the desert of Syria, bordering the land of Mesopotamia, is able to perform. Now, I have sound proof of his ability because of an incident that took place several years back. Two dignitaries came into Palestine to visit. They had heard about this man and they wanted to have audience with him. At that time, Palestine was governed by the British government, and the British government had placed as governor of Palestine a gentleman by the name of MacMichael. He was known as Sir MacMichael, and he served as the High Commissioner of Palestine, the head of the government in Palestine, subject to the British Crown. And these dignitaries came over to the High Commissioner and asked his help to get him an appointment with this man in the desert of Syria. And this High Commissioner, through his prestige and through his position, was able to work with the representative of this man in Damascus, Syria, to get an appointment for these two American dignitaries that came to have audience with this man. However, because they were not able to speak the English language, the High Commissioner, Sir MacMichael, provided them with an interpreter. And this interpreter, of course, was none other than my father, who served at this time as a postal inspector, censoring the mail that came through. My father is able to speak several languages, 7 or 8 languages. And therefore he was asked to serve as their interpreter. They made plans for the trip, and they headed towards the palace of this man. They were received by some of his representatives, and they were brought in this ultra-modern palace and shown into the chamber where they were to stay. And after they had rested and refreshed themselves a little bit, they were called over to the presence of this man. He knew their names before they introduced themselves. He knew what their mission was all about because he informed them of their mission. He called them by their names and he told them that you have come here to find out about me and about my powers and about my ability to perform miracles. And I'm going to satisfy your curiosity about myself. It's true that I am able to perform these wonders and these miracles that you have heard about. I am the forerunner of a personage that is going to come after me in the near future.
who is going to rule this world. And I am paving the way for him. He told them, let's take a walk outside the palace grounds. And they started walking out in the desert in the daytime. The sun was very hot. The temperature was somewhere around 135 to 137 degrees. And he told them that if they walked in his shadow, that they would feel as cool as though they were in an air-conditioned room. And sure enough, as they started walking out in the open desert, exposed to the heat of the sun, walked in the shadow of this man, and they did not feel any heat or any discomfort from the heat whatsoever, but they felt as comfortable and as cool as though they were in an air-conditioned place. In the process of their walking, they came across an old scrubby bush in the desert. And he stopped and he told them to watch the bush. And as they stood looking at the bush, he fixed his eyes upon that bush, and the bush caught fire and it was consumed in a matter of minutes. They started back to the palace. When they got back to the palace, he clapped his hands. Servants came to wait on him, and he told them to bring him a bird. They went to some area of the garden that had some birds there, and they brought him a bird. He held that bird in his hand, and he looked up toward the heavens, and he called for fire to come down, and fire came down and consumed that bird. He opened his hand where the bird was just a little dab of ashes in his hand. And he looked at those two dignitaries and said, what do you think about my powers now? In the meantime, it was time for the noon meal. And again, he led them into the dining area of the palace. They sat down around the table. He clapped his hands, and a servant appeared with a tray. And on this tray, there was some fruit. And this fruit resembled a date, but it was not a date. It looked like the size of a date, and the form and the shape of a date. However, it was not a date. And he told them to pick one of the fruit and eat it, and if they did, that they would be satisfied and they would feel comfortable and feel as though they had eaten a sumptuous meal. They'd feel invigorated and would feel refreshed by just that one fruit. And sure enough, when they ate that fruit, by their own testimony, they said that they felt refreshed and they felt satisfied as though they had eaten three sumptuous meals that day. Now he said, what do you think about my powers? Are you convinced that I have the power to perform miracles? One of those dignitaries looked at him and he said, there's one thing that you're not able to do that Jesus did. For you see, this man kept telling him that he had the same powers that Jesus Christ had while he was on this earth and could perform any miracle that Jesus performed. And they said, what is that? And he said, you can't raise the dead. Again, he clapped his hands and the servants came to him to find out what he needed, and he said, I want you to bring me a corpse. And after some time of waiting, They brought him a corpse that had been a man who had been dead for 4 days. And before the sheet was pulled back to expose the face of this dead man, he already knew what the name of that man was. And as they exposed the face of this man, this individual stood at the foot of that table where the corpse lay. And he looked at that man that was dead. No doubt about it, he'd been dead for 4 days. And he uttered the same words that Jesus uttered in the raising of the man Lazarus, with the exception of the name. He said, "Yusuf, come forth." Yusuf is Joseph in English. And sure enough, when he spoke those words, that dead man sat up, brought back to life. But the most amazing thing about this case was that from the moment that he brought that man back to life, and that time lasted for about 12 to 13 minutes, that man kept screaming at the top of his voice, "Please, Master, don't send me back to the place where you brought me from. Please, Master, don't send me back to the place where you brought me from." Begging this man not to send him back to the place where he had called him from. After a time of 12 or 13 minutes had passed, the man fell back dead on the couch. They rolled him out of the palace grounds. Now this man wears on the buckle of his belt around his robes the number 666 in the Arabic language. And he said that this was a mark of identification that will be introduced to the world at the ushering of the Superman that is going to rule the world. Now this number, of course, is not a new number. It is an earthly number, but it's not a new number. It is as old as Nimrod in the days of Babel. The Bible tells us that the man of sin that is going to rule the world in the beginning of the tribulation period and through the course of the tribulation period is going to have a number. In Revelation chapter 13, the last verse of this chapter, we read these words: "Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is a number of a man, and his number is 666. That is 666. And it is going to be the mark of identification that is going to be introduced to the world. Well, this man, the Antichrist, is going to cause all the small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, so much so that no man might buy or sell, save he that hath the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Therefore, this mark of identification is going to be introduced to the world in the days of the tribulation and must be taken by everyone who wants to survive during the course of the tribulation period while the Antichrist reigns. Now this number dates back all the way back to the days of Nimrod. For Nimrod himself was the first man who introduced this number to the world. The name Nimrod itself means a rebel. But Nimrod married a woman by the name of Semiramis, and Nimrod and Semiramis together started a cult that became known in time as the Babylonian cult, sometimes known as the mystical brotherhood, at other times known as the mother-child cult. And Nimrod became the high priest, the first high priest of this cult, and his wife Semiramis became the first high priestess of this cult. Now the name, the priestly name of Nimrod was Stur, spelled S-T-U-R. And the priestly name of Semiramis became known as Ishtar or Ashtaroth. And it's not coincidental that in several ancient languages, certain letters in those languages had numerical values. And every language that had such letters, that had numerical values, had so many letters that were considered as basic letters that served as basic numbers as well. For example, in the English numerical, we have 10 basic numbers. And then any number beyond the 10 basic numbers is a repetition of one of the 10 basic numbers. 1 is a basic number, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. These are all basic numbers in our numericals. However, when we continue counting past 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, all of these numbers past 10 are a repetition of the 10 basic numbers. 11 is a repetition of 1, 12 is a repetition of 12 and 1, 2 and 1, 13 is a repetition of 3 and 1, 25 is a repetition of 2 and 5, and so on and so forth. So it was in the Chaldean language, in the Phoenician language, in the Aramaic language, and in the Latin language, and also in the Roman language, or the language that was used by the Roman Empire. Therefore, when we consider the name Stur, all four letters in this name had numerical value. S was equivalent to 60, T was equivalent to 400, U was equivalent to 6, and R was equivalent to 200. Added together, they total up to 666. Well, Nimrod himself, whose high priestly name was Stur, was the first one to originate or introduce this identification number, which was the identification number of his priestly rank. Later on, a city was established somewhere around the 8th century which bore the name of Nimrod, the priestly name of Nimrod, and that city was called Saturn or Saturnia. In time, the city's name was changed to assume the name of a famous general, Romulus, and it became known as Romulus, and in time to the city that we know today as Rome. However, the original name of the city was Shobab Anisha, which of course, interpreted from the old Aramaic language, is Saturnia or Saturn. And of course, the priestly name of his wife symbolized also the mother-child cult that was established in the days of Nimrod and continued to grow through the era of the Babylonian rule. And from Babylon it moved to the city of Pergamos, from Pergamos to this city of Saturnia, or the city of Rome, and from Rome to the four corners of the earth. The name of Nero Caesar in the Hebrew is Neron Caesar, and the numerical value of the letters in the name Nero Caesar also total to 666. The Latin language has some basic numericals, and the basic numericals in the Latin language total to 666. For L is equivalent to 30 being a basic language, A is equivalent to 1 being one of the basic numbers, T is equivalent to 300, E is equivalent to 5, I is equivalent to 10, N is equivalent to 50, O is equivalent to 70, and S is equivalent to 200. For the word Latin in Latin language is Latinos, therefore the total value of these letters, numerical wise, is equal to 666. The Roman numbers, which were in the Grecian language, really, had six basic letters that had numerical value. D is equivalent to 500, which is one of the six basic letters. C is equivalent to 100. L is equivalent to 50. X is equivalent to 10. V is equivalent to 5. And I is equivalent to 1. Total together, they make up 666. Well, you see, all through the progress of this apostate religion that was altogether anti-God and transgressed the government of God and transgressed the statutes of the Lord had this number for an identification number. It is not strange also that the letters on the Pope's crown or mitre have the equivalent value of 666 numerical wise. So this number has been an identification number to the apostate religion that Satan introduced to the world to counterattack the plan of God and the purpose of God in the person of Jesus Christ. Here was this man, way out here in the desert of Syria, living in an ultramodern palace, was able to perform such tremendous miracles, calling fire from heaven to come down and consume a fowl in his hand, staring at a bush in the desert, and the bush catching on fire and being consumed in a matter of minutes, walking in the open desert, exposed to the heat of the sun, and the shadow that he cast served as a shade to anyone who walked in his shadow, able to even bring the dead back to life for a short period of time. And one of the most amazing things that these three men experienced, the two dignitaries along with my father, was the nights that they spent in that palace. They spent 3 days and three nights there. And whenever they retired to their chambers to go to bed at night, from the first night, they began to experience this. They said that as they entered into their bedroom chamber, right away they felt the harassment of demon spirit and demon powers. All night long, they had to struggle against those demons. And these demons would close in on them. And it was only faith of these three men in the name of Jesus Christ and the blood of Jesus Christ that was able to deliver them from being destroyed by these demons in that chamber. For every time they felt beset by demons and demon power, and they felt like these demons were closing in on them, they would breathe the name of Jesus and plead the blood. That would cause those demons to get away from them and to leave them alone for a while. Then they would come back again to harass them and beset them You would have to call on the name of Jesus again and plead the blood. And all night long this went on. They were not able to get any rest whatsoever at night. However, in the daytime when they partook of the fruit that was offered them, one fruit per day, they felt refreshed and they felt invigorated as though they had slept all night long a peaceful and comfortable sleep. Now, we are not saying that this man is the Antichrist. However, we are fairly sure that this man is going to play a major role in ushering in or the introduction of the Antichrist himself. For he seems to claim the position of the false prophet or the forerunner of the Antichrist, and he's proved it by the power that he has displayed in the wonders and the miracles and the signs that he has performed before my father and these two dignitaries, so that when those men walked away from him, they felt convinced that this man has a great part to play in the drama of the reign of the Antichrist. Now, of course, the Antichrist, as we said before, is going to reign for 7 years. That is, during the whole of Daniel's 70th week. Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, tells us for the first 3.5 years he will confirm the covenant. After the rapture takes place, the Jews will be gathered back in their homeland unconverted. The Antichrist will make a covenant with the Jews, and this covenant will be kept for 3.5 years. Then at the middle of the week, he will break it. For the balance of his 3.5 years of reign, he will cause great persecution to come on the Jews. This, of course, will include other nations and peoples on this earth as well. And his doom, of course, will come as a result of the appearance of the Messiah. Jesus fighting the forces of the Antichrist and the false prophet. Both the beast and the false prophet will be cast into the lake of fire. God's wrath against those that accept the mark of the beast is mentioned in Revelation chapter 14 and verses 9 through 13. Listen to these words. And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast and his image and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment descendeth up forever and ever. They have no rest day nor night to worship the beast and his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. We feel sure then, as we have mentioned in this study of the Antichrist, that the background of the Antichrist is going to be of that of an apostate Jew. Now, we feel that this apostate Jew will be linked tribal-wise with the tribe of Dan, because Dan has been called in the Bible both a lion's whelp and a serpent. He has been a blasphemer. His name means God hath judged me, and from the beginning he tried to destroy the seed of Joseph, so that the Savior will not come from that seed. And last but not least, before we close this discourse, we've got to add this commentary to it by telling you that the strongest proof that we have that Dan is the tribe that the Antichrist is going to come from is mentioned in the 7th chapter of the book of Revelation, when this chapter, of course, enumerates that 12 tribes will have 12,000 of each as part of the remnant, making up the 144,000 that will be saved at the close of the tribulation period. And John, in the naming of these tribes, does not include the tribe of Dan. We find out that Dan has been replaced by none other than the seed of Joseph himself. For reading from the fifth verse, of the tribe of Judah were sealed 12,000, of the tribe of Reuben were sealed 12,000, of the tribe of Gad were sealed 12,000, of the tribe of Asher were sealed 12,000, of the tribe of Naphtali were sealed 12,000, of the tribe of Manasseh were sealed 12,000. Manasseh, of course, replaced Dan because he was the son of Joseph. Of the tribe of Simeon were sealed 12,000, of the tribe of Levi were sealed 12,000, of the tribe of Issachar were sealed 12,000, of the tribe of Zebulun were sealed 12,000, of the tribe of Joseph, of the tribe of Joseph were sealed 12,000, of the tribe of Benjamin were sealed 12,000. So will you notice carefully, if you have followed the reading of the names of the 12 tribes mentioned here, that Dan has been taken out, and replacing him was one of the sons of Joseph by the name of Manasseh. Now, we know that we are living in the last days. We know that the rapture of the church is very imminent. We know that the circumstances revolving around the introduction of the Antichrist of this world are already present. The world is already planning for a joint or consolidation of its powers under the form of government that the Antichrist will be heading. The monetary systems are being consolidated together to form one monetary system. And the identification number has become very prominent in our day, so much so that everyone must have some sort of identification number to be able to buy or sell own any property whatsoever. And therefore, all of this is conducive to let us know that the rapture of the church is very imminent, and immediately following the rapture, the Antichrist will introduce himself as a leader of the world. I thank God that God has made it possible and provided for the escape of the church from this world that is going to suffer not only the wrath of the Antichrist, but the wrath of God as well, unleashed without measure. Some time ago in the city of Luxembourg, while we were in a shoe store looking around for shoes, I happened to pick up a shoe and just to inspect it and look it over. Lo and behold, on the inside of the shoe where the heel of the foot rests, there was a tag there glued, and the tag had a picture of a circle on it. The circle was divided by a line in half. In the top half of the circle was a picture of a lamb with two horns in the process of saying something, and the bottom half of the circle had the number 666. And after talking with the owner of the store, we found out that this identification tag is going to be used by all of the common market countries on all of their textile goods, the leather goods, and no country will be allowed to sell any of their goods until they have this stamp on the piece of good or the piece of merchandise. So you see, the stage is set for the appearance of the Antichrist, and it behooves every one of us to know for sure that we are ready for the coming of the Lord. Not long ago, in the United Nations, something very interesting took place. At the recent meeting of the UN organization in Geneva, Switzerland, the speaker made the following statement. Plans are worked out to dissolve the United Nations to make room for a world tribunal which will seize all possessions, savings, and personal bank deposits. Every man, woman, and child will receive a certain amount of money and number. This money is waiting now and is available in deposit in the bank and waiting for distribution. Everyone with a number will be employed in the administration, the commercial, the industrial, the agricultural branch of it, and the economic as well. This project or plan calls for the total unification of state and church and also provides for a single form of worship for all. The appointed day for all people and all nations will be on Sunday, and the number received by all people will permit them to buy and sell. When the speaker was asked what would happen to the minorities who will not accept the plan, he answered, "Their numbers will be canceled with a black line and they shall eventually be destroyed." If you buy a pair of shoes in one of the common market countries today, you'll find out that this stamp is in them. And of course, I said before, it consists of a circle with a line to the middle. Above the line is a lamb's head with two horns and a mouth as it's speaking. And under the line is a number, 666. May God bless you that listen to this tape. Prepare yourself for the great event of the rapture of the church, and thus be counted worthy to escape the wrath that is to come upon the face of this earth.